Heard a really interesting interview this past week with a mom and a son. Some of you guys will be aware of this story. It's been in the Canadian news rotation the last couple of weeks. We'll get to why that is in a bit. But mom's name is Kristen Barnett, and her son's name is Jacob. There are a lot of ways to define people. And in this story, when Jacob was a toddler, right around the same time that he learned to talk, he stopped talking. And he stopped talking abruptly, and he stopped talking for just over a year and a half. Didn't say a thing. And he was diagnosed in that period, partly because of the talking cessation, but also because there seemed to be other tasks that would be developmentally aligned with that age that he wasn't able to do. He was diagnosed as being severely autistic. And one special ed consultant told his mom, Kristen, that she might as well stop giving Jacob alphabet flashcards because he'd never read. But she didn't see it that way, and it soon became clear to her that although Jacob did face some really serious developmental challenges, he also had these moments of just absolutely startling insight. And at one point when he was three and he wasn't speaking, his mom noticed that she'd given him just hundreds of crayons, and he'd taken all his crayons and he had organized them all by color, and which is, you know, kind of interesting in itself, but he had organized them by color in the order of the colors of the rainbow, which for those of you who remember, you know, high school science is the spectrum of visible light. So the question naturally arose, how might Jacob know the spectrum? So his father asked him that question. How did you know what order to put the colors in, Jacob? And he didn't say anything. There was a glass of water sitting on the table, and he took the glass of water and he rotated it until the sunlight coming in through the window shone through the glass and made the spectrum on the table. Interesting stuff going on. His mom, in this story, was kind of a rebel. She didn't really buy the approach that the therapists were using. And I tell a story like this, like lots of stories, with, I want to put a caveat in here. I want to say that I'm telling this story to illustrate a particular thing, and that leaves a lot out. So this is not me offering some kind of blanket critique. This is just the way the story went. She wasn't buying what they were selling, so to speak. And she kept trying to find ways to help Jacob focus on what seemed to intrigue and captivate him. And there wasn't much he could do. I mean, he's a little kid, for one thing. And he's a little non-communicative kid at this stage for another. And so there just weren't a lot of options. But one of the things that he loved to do was look at the stars. And so they'd go outside at night and just lay there in the backyard and look at the stars. And then she saw an ad in the paper, and they lived in the States, for Holcomb Observatory, which is on the campus of Butler University. And they advertised that they would let visitors look at Mars through their telescope for free. And so she took Jacob down to look at Mars through the telescope. What they failed to mention in the ad was that in order to get access to the telescope, you had to sit through a lecture by one of their profs from that department. And so they had to sit through the lecture. So they sit through this whole lecture. And at the end of the lecture, which is about Mars, the prof asks why the moons of Mars are oblong rather than round. They're shaped like potatoes. And Jacob puts up his hand. He's not talking. All right? So you just have to try to be mom in this story just for a second. He puts up his hand and he says, "Excuse me, but could you please tell me the size of the moons?" And so the prof tells him they're quite small. And Jacob says, "The gravitational effects of the moons are not large enough to pull them into complete spheres." Try to be his mother, just for a second. Okay, he hasn't said anything for like a year and a half. And then, up comes this, right? As it turns out, that is in fact the correct answer. That's why the moons of Mars are shaped like potatoes, because they have insufficient mass to be pulled into complete spheres. By the time he was 8, he was auditing courses at Indiana University. At 11, he dropped out of 5th grade to enroll in university full-time. He has since done a TEDx teen talk that has 1.5 million hits. His mom's written a best-selling book called The Spark, A Mother's Story of Nurturing Genius. The story's in the Canadian news cycle right now because they just moved to Canada. They just moved to Waterloo as a family. And they did that so that Jacob could study at the Perimeter Scholars International Institute, which is in Waterloo, which is a master's program that's designed to attract exceptional physics scholars from all over the world. He's now 15 years old, and he is being predominantly defined rather than as severely autistic as a genius. He still wears flip-flops because he can't tie his shoes. He's an extraordinary guy. I'm a math disaster. I got through high school math. I have a math credit, thank you very much. And I got it because there were three levels of math, and I managed to get through the middle one because Faith Breyer, who was way smarter, no pun intended, brighter than me, sat right beside me and helped me. I didn't actually look at her tests, but she helped me. And so I listened to this interview with Jacob, and they're him and his mom together, they're telling this story, and he starts, the interviewer asks him this great question about what it's like for him to do high-level math, to do this crazy physics stuff that he does. And he says, well, he's just really soft-spoken. He's a really gracious interview. I mean, for any 15-year-old, never mind an extraordinary one like this. And he just kind of calmly says to the interviewer, well, you know, he says, when I think about math, what I see are shapes and colors. I see pictures. He says, math isn't hard. If everybody could just see the pictures, they'd get it right away. So, and I'm thinking, oh, Jacob, you know, I can't. Like, I hear you, but I can't. I'd like to. One of the best decisions I ever made in my life was marrying somebody that can balance a checkbook, you know? But I'm not seeing any pictures. I'm seeing somewhere on the spectrum between dark gray to black, you know? No colors, no shapes. Jacob and I are living in the same world. We're looking at the same stuff, but we are seeing it completely different. And in this case, I can't see it like he does, even if I want to, and I do want to. I would like to be remediated in this regard. There's an interesting story that's kind of folded into this one, and that's the story of the mom's view of things. Kristen did not see the world around her, and she did not see her son the way that the prevailing system that she was in did. To the specialists, Jacob was a severely autistic kid that would never read and perhaps never even speak, but his mom saw or sensed something else, and she pursued that something else with the kind of determination that I'd be willing to suggest is probably only really accounted for by a thing like love. During the years that story was unfolding, what Kristen was doing occupationally was running a daycare, a home daycare, and she worked with Jacob and has come to work with her daycare kids and subsequently with the Weekend Center for Autistic Children that she has started out of her own philosophy, which she calls muchness. I'm not going to kind of unpack her philosophy in any extensive way this morning, but the short version of her philosophy of parenting, in this case, is that parents should encourage their kids' passions instead of trying to remediate their flaws. When you take a whole philosophy of education and you crunch it into a sentence like that, obviously you leave a lot out, right? But that's sort of the short version of what she calls muchness. So if the kids in her daycare are into crayons, she's going to make sure they've got every crayon that she can find. If they're into boats, they're going to be making boats. And there's an interesting corollary to this, and I want you to just stay with me. This has a lot to do with God, with the table, with the quest for faith in general, and we will get there. Neil Turok, who is the South African cosmologist who directs the Perimeter Institute. Turok not only directs this institute with all these brilliant young physics scholars, but he goes back to his home country, to Africa, and he runs math clinics in Africa. And this is how he talks about that same thing that Kristen was doing. He says this, what I see out there, and through my work in Africa, is an ocean of talent, which by and large, standard educational institutions are failing to tap. It's the outliers, the oddballs, the unusual kids who often have the most to offer. And our whole system, Turok says, this is a continuation of the quote, our whole system has turned into a factory. We crank people through certificates, qualifications, degrees, and stultify, don't reward, creativity and unusual ideas, which we all know is what counts. Close quote. That's interesting. Maybe something that Kristen said about Jacob in a different interview sums all of this up. She said, I was always determined to let him explore his world. As a community, and Jason reminded us of this a number of different ways this morning already, as a community we have said that the core of our reason for being is this sense that in this particular community, we are here to make room to explore belief, to explore what we believe. Exploration can take a bit of courage sometimes. We have to be willing, if we're going to explore, we have to be willing to step away from what appears to be the comfort of what is normative, standard, accepted as the way things are. We have to be willing to get into that terrain where we say, as Jacob's mom has said over and over again, I don't see it that way. When it comes to faith, when it comes to the exploration of belief, when it comes to seeking for God, believing in God, there seem to be some unique biases against exploration. I don't know if you've ever had this experience in a conversation where you've kind of floated an idea. Maybe it could have been a religious idea, could have been generally a spiritual idea, may have been uniquely Christian, may not. But you kind of float an idea in a conversation, and maybe everyone's civil and polite, but you kind of get this sensation in a conversation, you know, it's like, why would you bother to put time and energy into thinking about that? Why would anyone do that? I'm sure if you think about this framework and you think about the media, you can taste this sometimes in the prevailing North American media, where somebody perhaps makes a confession of faith where they haven't before publicly. And you listen to an interview with somebody like that, and you can hear it in the interviewer kind of going, well, why? And the undertone is, why would any thinking person, you know? Yeah, so that's one kind of resistance that we experience in the culture to the exploration of belief. But I'm going to be kind of going down this path for the next little while about why we would explore belief, why we would bother making room for this, why it matters to do this. What I want to do for the balance of the time that I'm going to take this morning is I want to kind of give us a bit of a whirlwind history of Western thought tour about one of the ways we think in the West that kind of make this a realm that's just not broached very much. So, if you were hoping for a Bible story, I'm just going to let you down right now. It's not that there aren't any, but we kind of got to background this, right? Most of you know that when our family goes on vacation, what we do is mountain bike. That's pretty much all day, every day. That's just what we do. Saw a shirt in Fernie when we were there that said, get up, bike, drink beer, sleep, repeat. And aside from replacing drink beer with some other ways of nourishing oneself, that's sort of what we do. And biking, mountain biking in particular, is a gravity sport. And so one of the things that means in a self-propelled gravity sport is that when you're going up, gravity is not your friend. And when you're going down, gravity is your friend, usually. So I'm a photographer, so one of the things my kids have to put up with, because I want to come home with some good pictures, and I know as a photographer, if you want to take good pictures, you can't just take snapshots, you actually have to pay attention. So every once in a while, one of the kids and I will go on a particular ride, and we choose it carefully, and we choose the day, so we got the light we want, and we say, this is a ride where we're riding to shoot. And when the ride doesn't have any flow, we chop it all up so we can do the things we need to do to get good photographs, right? So you got to set this stuff up. So I was out for a ride with Kale one day, and Reed said, this is the ride. This is the day we're going to ride to shoot today. I want to come home with good pictures of Kale mountain biking. So we'd set up this particular shot on a trail, and it was a bit of a downhill with a tight turn, and the light was coming in the right direction, and it's nice and looser soil in that turn, and I thought, I'm going to like this. It's going to be carves into there. It's going to be a little bit of dust, and the light's going to come through. It's going to be a nice shot. And what I want to do is I actually want to show you the pictures of what happened. Yeah, so this is what that looked like when Kale came into this turn. So hang on, I'm gonna show you this. I just kept pushing the button down. There's nothing else I could do, right? There you go. So, I did ask Kale for permission. He said, you're going to show them all? Sure. So usually, gravity is your friend when you're going downhill. He was fine, by the way. A little bit of road rash. But he was experiencing something that we all learned about in high school. And when we learned about it in high school, we learned it as a law of Newtonian physics. And that law states, and with a couple of rounds of practice, we could probably say this together, that law states that an object in motion stays in motion unless acted on by an outside force. So one way to explain what we just saw here, right, is that is that kale's momentum and mass and gravity and the loose soil, which provided resistance that was unexpected, conspired together to launch him into space, and he stayed in space until that same combination of mathematical factors brought him back to Earth, and then the resistance of the Earth slowed him down, and eventually the tree provided a final, and so on. We could explain it all by Newtonian physics, right? Here's the thing. Newtonian physics, the laws that Newton gave us for how the universe works, are so much a part of our way of thinking about the world that we don't think about thinking about them. And it's easy to forget that when he introduced them, when he published his opus, Principia, in 1687, when he published that work, what he was offering was a brand new explanation of the way that the world works. Before Newton, and I realize I'm kind of putting this singular point on the line of the evolution of thought about physics, but it's pretty singular in this case. Before Newton, if you would have asked people, generally speaking, why does the world work the way that it works? Why does that happen when you tangle your front tire up in loose soil at high speed on a downhill? They would have said something along the lines of, because that's the way God made the world. Because that's the way it is. And the explanation for the way it is God made it that way. And before Newton, nobody was offering, in the prevailing cultural ethos, nobody was offering another explanation. What people would have thought of as the way we come to know things before Newton was revelation. God makes it clear to us. But Newton didn't see it that way. Newton insisted that there were predictable, knowable, rational rules and explanations that govern how the universe operates. There are causes that lead to effects, and there are clear linkages between the two, and that's why we can explain that series of events very roughly the way that I just did. Now that is a very appealing way of understanding a lot of things about how the universe works. And it caught on. It's not like nobody had ever used reason and logic before, but Newton's work went off like a rocket in the culture. And more natural explanations were discovered, which eventually led to the idea of a clock, the metaphor of a clock with its precise measurements and its enduring consistency, replacing the actions of the gods as the primary way that people understood the way the universe functioned. And so we move from a universe that is primarily mystic, if you want, to a world that is primarily mechanical under Newton's brilliant work. And so there's this whole new way of seeing the world that comes into prominence, and it's a way that's precise, and it's orderly, and it's regular, and it's exact, and it's predictable. And along with, this is the thing about the way our lens on the world works, along with new ways of conceiving the physical world come new ways of thinking about how we know what we know. And that brings us back into this realm that I was talking about before with Revelation. We've all heard Rene Descartes saying, "I think, therefore I am." We've probably seen t-shirts that make various versions of that, that try to, attempt to keep it interesting. Anyway, but unless we've taken a philosophy class or we've read in that realm, we might never have considered how radical that was when Descartes said it. Because before Descartes compresses this idea into this pithy, lovely little soundbite, I mean, you can tweet that. Before he does this, this is not the view of the world and humans in the world that prevails. Descartes launches the same kind of shift in magnitude in the way we think about what it means to be human in the universe with "I think, therefore I am," that Newton launches with his physical laws. Because before Descartes says that we know things by thinking of them primarily, revelation dominated. How do we know things? God shows them to us. Descartes comes along and says, "No, we know things by thinking about them." The center of the universe moved under that idea. Descartes was insisting that we don't know what we know because some divine being chose to reveal it to us, but we know what we know through our own reason and our own logic. That's how we learn things. That's how we know them. And that gives us, and I'm really going to compress some history, that gives us this period in history that's, that we would now look back on called the Golden Age of Certainty. And that era gave us what we now know as the scientific method. And like Newton's way of thinking, this is the method we probably all learned in high school somewhere, some version of, you know. And what we do in the scientific method, in brief, is we test things. We use reason and logic. We explore things. We poke them. We prod them. We measure them, and we remeasure them, and we compile data, and we look for consistencies in the data and patterns and inconsistencies. And on this basis, we reach verifiable conclusions. That shifts the picture of the human person, and it shifts it like this. It shifts the human person in the universe from being a passive recipient of the knowledge that the gods might choose to dispense, and it shifts that picture of what it means to be human into the picture of what it means to be human to be somebody who's like this sort of the prevailing image is the scientist, one way or another, who stands over the subject, detached and objective, and they make precise observations, and that's how they arrive at valid conclusions. It's a different picture of what it means to be a human. Well, that kind of combination of Newton's work, Descartes' work, there's other people in the picture, obviously, but I'm going to pick on them as illustrative this morning. That launches us in our chunk of history into this explosion of discovery. Just incredible. These are ideas that have been at work in the Western world for a few hundred years. That's such a minuscule piece of history. But what has happened in terms of knowledge, technology, all those kind of advances in that same period is staggering. Heard an interview on the drive-in this morning with a guy, he's 93 now, he was a pilot, a World War II pilot, came back from the war and joined, he lives in Winnipeg, he joined MTS early on, early days for them, and he told the story in this interview about going down to Seattle to meet with the people from IBM because they were considering the possibility of using computers as part of the phone system. And he said in advance of that meeting, he had to look up the word computer because he didn't know what that was. I heard his interview today. He's alive. Okay. Lots has changed in a really short time. And we, this is the sea we swim in, right? We're surrounded by so much that is good, so much that is positive, that is the fruit of this era of thought, this picture of what it means to be a human being. It's this way of thinking that pulled the Western world out of the Dark Ages, out of the medieval period, and into this whirlwind. It's like a leap, if you look at it, in terms of any kind of a continuum of history, this Enlightenment thing. It's enormously powerful. Here's the but. Those Enlightenment ways of understanding the world have limits. And some of those limits become very, very visible when we start to ask questions about how we think and talk about God. This is where we bang into them in ways that are just like right there. Some of those limits are the exact reasons why it can feel hard to feel free to explore the realm of God and faith and belief in the 21st century in the West. I'll try to illustrate that a little bit in wrapping up what we're going to do here today. One of the limits of the Enlightenment way of understanding the world is that it affects how we filter knowledge, how we filter knowing. Over those few hundred years of emphasizing knowing things through reason and logic, other ways of knowing things have been de-emphasized. If the only way that we can legitimately know things is through scientific method, then what happens when we know something in a way that bypasses that method? Does everything that we know, another way to ask the question is, does everything that we know have to be proven intellectually? Now, to raise this question in the setting of church makes me nervous for maybe not the reason that you think. Maybe it is. I don't know. Trevor's laughing. I know. I have to take him for coffee and find out why he was laughing. Anyways. But the reason I get nervous is because of what the 20th century in particular has made of Christianity.
Which is, this is the point where the fundamentalist preacher says, you don't have to think, just believe. If you've been around the table for a while, you already know that that's not where this is going. Okay? But that's what prevails out there in the culture, right? This is the point where Christians jump off, where they go, just, it's faith, man. If it was something else, we'd call it something else. Bible says it, I believe it, that settles it. Right. Anyway, another day. But that's what makes me twitch when I say something like I just said. But this is not where I'm headed. So if you were surfing that way when you came in here, just be at peace or be distressed or whatever. But that's not where I'm going. The question was, that got me off on that little rant, was does everything that we have to believe be proven intellectually? Which could sound like a question about belief being anti-intellectual. Let me illustrate it this way. One of the things that I've been having lots of fun doing in the community of the table is pre-marriage counseling. And which I really enjoy. My wife, who has lived with me long enough to know that I'm only an expert by virtue of having made mistakes, thinks that this is a little ridiculous that I do this, but I said, honey, I've got good material from other experts and I have my own experience of folly to draw on, and why shouldn't I be able to offer something good here, you know? One of the things that would make me really nervous for a couple that were preparing to marry is if I asked them why they fell in love with the person they fell in love with, and what they gave me back was data. I would probably say, my best advice to you is bail now, right? It's just not the kind of answer you get when you say, why do you love that person? You may get some information, but you're going to get strange things from the vantage point of reason and logic, like, I feel filled up. I feel like the world kind of comes alive when I'm with them and they're with me. I feel like you get all this kind of soft-sided, how the heck are we going to measure that kind of stuff, right? You wouldn't get the scientific method, probably. That's interesting. I was listening to Cale. I was an over-invested parent. So let me just confess that up front. But Cale's a singer-songwriter. He's a musician. Loves that stuff. And he's working on his voice. His guitar skills and his songwriting skills are stronger than his singing skills. And so we've been looking for a new vocal coach for him. And so we were in this interview with this vocal coach. And it was an interview that kind of mattered because she's not taking students. And we'd gotten in there through a connection and yada, yada. And it was like one shot, you know, if we thought this was a good idea. So she asked him to sing something. He said, well, you know what? I do my own stuff best. So he starts singing her one of his songs. And it's about a pop star. You don't have to listen real hard to it to kind of know this is about Bieber's story. Although it doesn't name that story. But it's about a young pop singer who loses his grip on the world because the paparazzi tell him everything's yours. Just the experiences he's having say the world is yours. You can have everything you see. How do you tell somebody who's 19 who made $55 million last year that they can't have something, right? So he writes this song about this thing. And I'm in the interview. There's the three of us. There's this vocal coach. There's Cale. He's sitting there facing her. He's singing this song. I'm kind of off in the wings trying not to be over-involved, you know? And he hits the chorus where the young singer says, I couldn't see who cared for me. And I am sitting over in the corner of the interview, and I'm just like, this poor coach. She said yes, by the way, so it's all, maybe she just didn't look, I don't know, but there was something that happened inside of that song in that moment for me where I went, man, that is so true. This person, this character in this story is losing their grip on their whole world because they can't see who really loves them and what really matters. How tragic is that? Yeah, I'm having my little emotional moment over there, you know, in the corner. I know that happened. I know it happened. You want me to prove it? Want me to subject it to the zenith of enlightenment thought and method? Can't do it. I mean, I could call for verification, but I hope nobody looked, actually, just then, because it wasn't about me. We bang into the limits of this view of the universe for all that is good and lovely and positive and rich about it. We bang into its limits when we get into the realm
spirit.
Which leads me, at least, to believe that there have to be ways of knowing things other than only through the intellect. And in the lab, I can stand over things. I can dominate. I can poke and prod and act on and test. And I could see things through the lens of rational repeatability. But in my life, there seem to be things that act on me sometimes. And it's less like standing over something and prevailing over it than like getting jumped in an alley. You know? I wasn't sitting over there in the corner of that interview with Cale expecting to have an emotional experience with a song that I've heard 100 times and played with him. It wasn't a surprise what was in that song. It was a surprise what that song had to say to me just then. It's a different thing. There's way too much about life, you guys, that won't fit through the lens of objectivity, for me at least, to accept that this is the only legitimate way of knowing. I've talked before here about how our relationship to culture is like fish to water. We're in it, but we're not it. We've been swimming in enlightenment culture and thinking for so long that it's possible that we've started to lose touch with other ways of knowing. We've lost some skill. We've lost some inclination. We've maybe been so busy as a culture enjoying and benefiting from the things that are in that sea that we're only now starting to realize that it isn't totally good for us. And it's like our brains have built a fence around our hearts and cut us off from ways of knowing that would be hard to prove in the lab. But here's the thing. For all of our poking and prodding and all the benefits we've accrued, we've only been around for about 0.0001% of the planet's history. 97% of the Earth's species still haven't been discovered. And all of the bones that we've dug up to explain our ancestry would roughly fill my 8x10 utility trailer. The point being that there's a lot we don't know. And in that realm of a lot we don't know, a good-sized piece, if you will, is the piece that's about God and belief and faith. Science does a great job of explaining why I don't have a tail, but it can't explain why I find that interesting. It's good with parts and pieces, but it's not so good with soul. It can explain how we evolved, but not why sometimes something just goes off inside of us and says, you know, there is something here that needs to be explored by both the mind and the heart. When I think about making this community a place where there's room to explore, the picture that I get, maybe this is from having been at a lot of weddings, but the picture that I get is kind of a church basement wedding reception picture, town hall wedding reception picture. You know how this goes, right? Sometimes everybody's got the table set up and there's chairs around the tables and you have the meal and that's all good. And whoever served clears out and that's all good too. And then they say something like, you know, we just need a few minutes so we can get the tables and the chairs out of the way so we can dance. Right? And we start clearing things off to the side and making room for the dance. The dance partners of this realm that I've been trying to let us in on historically this morning, the dance partners are things that are often construed as enemies, not partners. They're things like faith and science. They're not enemies, they're dance partners. Belief and doubt. Another interesting pair of dance partners. And if I have a picture of a good life for us as a community, when we gather, it's a picture of clearing the chairs away, metaphorically, and making room for that dance. This is not an either-or idea. This is a both-and idea. And the substantial exploration of belief calls us neither to abandon the intellect, nor to wall off the heart with the intellect, but to fully engage both, knowing that these things have something to say to one another that is essential. We'll get to the problem of language in due course here, because that is part of the problem. You need different kinds of language for different kinds of exploration. But we have to make room for that dance. We're going to make room to explore fully. And that means one of the things we have to be willing to be critical of the framework that we swim in. Not just the Enlightenment framework, although that's what I've been pushing on this morning, but also the prevailing religious framework. Part of which, by the way, is so deeply rooted in Enlightenment thought and belief that it's kind of mind blowing to see you stand back for a split second and realize this has everything to do with why you should not suggest something new in the realm of religion. Because religion has been trying to behave like Enlightenment belief. Make things precise, predictable, measurable. Anyway,
that's my picture. And my hope is that this year we can do some of that work of clearing the chairs away to make room for the dance that is exploring what we believe. And I hope that at least sometimes in that process we can shed enough of our Enlightenment heritage to enjoy the party. Peace.